But we've been studying through 2 Timothy. We've done the first two chapters, and we're on chapter 3. So 2 Timothy chapter 3, part 1, which I call the prophecy for today. So we've been talking about the book of 2 Timothy was Paul's last book. And I believe it contains the Lord's final instructions to those of us who believe today. Timothy faced rejection by the majority of God's people. We saw that. He was in Ephesus, and Paul said, "All who are in Asia have turned away from me," in chapter 1. Well, Timothy was in Asia. Timothy was Paul's representative. So Paul says, "You know this." I think they knew it because Timothy was there to see it happen, and they were rejecting him along with Paul. But he was to seek the minority of people who would still hear the truth. So now Paul tells Timothy an important truth, which is a prophecy for today. Now normally we think about Paul's books like 2 Timothy are talking about this dispensation of grace. And therefore we say they aren't talking about God's prophetic program. And I believe that. We live in a time which interrupts God's prophesied kingdom work. This dispensation of grace we live in is like a parenthesis. I compare it to a parenthesis in the sentence of God's kingdom work, that God has put the pause button on his kingdom work and is doing this work, which is an interruption. It's a parenthesis. It's inserted into his kingdom work, and it interrupts it. So if you look through the prophecy of the Old Testament, you're not going to find prophecies of God's work today because it's an interruption in the prophecies. Yet here in 2 Timothy chapter 3, Paul, writing in this dispensation of grace, gives us a prophecy for today. And I believe that it's a prophecy of what it will be like in the last days of this secret dispensation, this hidden dispensation in which we are living. So that's why I call this a prophecy for today. And Paul's prophecy here is what we could call the syndrome of the last days. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1. He says, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come." So he says, "This know also." And that's like saying, be aware of this. Paul wants Timothy and us as well to be aware of this. Which is what? That in the last days. The last days. Well, what does that mean, the last days? So what does that phrase mean? Well, last there is the Greek word eschatos, E-S-C-H-A-T-O-S. And that's a word, if you're familiar with theology, you know that eschatology is the study of last things, right? If you've heard of eschatology, especially people study the tribulation period and the millennium and so forth, they call that eschatology. That's the study of the future, God's future plan. But eschatos means last. But it doesn't necessarily mean the last one. Like, for example, if I speak of my last dollar, well, my last dollar would mean the last one I have, right? I don't have any more. The thing is, the word last doesn't always mean that. For example, if we look at Matthew chapter 12 and verse 45. And in Matthew 12, verse 45, the Lord is telling about the demon who is cast out of the man he was possessing. And he seeks a new home. He can't find it. He's going through the wilderness. He wants to be possessing someone. He can't find anyone. So he says, "I'll go back and return to my house I came out from." And he goes back and he finds it empty, uninhabited, swept, garnished, furnished, all ready for him. So in Matthew 12, 45, it says, "Then goeth he, and taketh with himself 7 other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there." And he says, "And the last state of that man is worse than the first." So the last state of that man is worse than the first. Now, is that the last state the man is ever going to be in? Well, maybe not. You know, he might meet the Lord. The Lord might cast all 8 demons out. And was the first state he was in, does that mean the first state ever? Was he born demon-possessed? Was he conceived demon-possessed? No, of course not. So you can see here that the first state actually means the former state. Right? The former of the two states. The former state was when he was possessed with one demon. And then last here means the result. The result of the first demon being cast out, his resultant state is not being free of demons, but it's actually having eight demons. So this shows us that last can sometimes mean result. And that's true of the Greek word eschatos. It sometimes means resultant. So last can mean resulting, and first can mean former. So he's speaking of the last days. These could be called the concluding days, but they could also be called the resultant days. The resultant days. And this helps us to figure out a strange biblical puzzle that a lot of people have puzzled over. And that is that the Bible sometimes seems to speak about the last days as if they're wonderful, and it sometimes seems to speak about the last days as if they're terrible. Let's look at Acts chapter 2 and verse 17. Acts 2 and is, as we know, the record of what happened at Pentecost. And Peter is speaking to the people, and he says in Acts chapter 2, verse 17, he's quoting the prophet Joel, where he says, "And it shall come to pass in the last days," that's eschatos again, "in the last days, saith God, I will pour out of my spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams." So these are definitely good things, right? The Spirit poured out on all flesh, sons and daughters prophesying, young men seeing visions, old men seeing dreams. That's good. God's Spirit coming on everyone. And I could show you other passages where it speaks of the last days with people coming to God, and it seems to be wonderful. But then we look here at 2 Timothy 3, and these last days are perilous. These last days are sinful. These last days are undesirable. So we ask, how can the last days be wonderful and terrible at the same time? But if we understand that the last days speak of the days that result from something, then we understand that we need to ask, the last days that result from what? The last days of what? And I believe that the Acts 2, the wonderful last days, are the days that result from God bringing in his kingdom and from all his long work to do that. The call of Israel to be his kingdom of priests, his all the way to Christ's death on the cross in order to forgive our sins. You know, he can never bring his kingdom to earth without Christ's death on the cross. So Acts 2 is speaking of the last days, the result from all God's long work to bring in his kingdom. Whereas 2 Timothy 3 is talking about the last days, the result in God's long display of grace. God's long display of grace and favor toward the world, because that's what God's been doing for nearly 2,000 years now. He's been showing grace and favor to the world. Now, it should not surprise us that God showing grace results in men becoming wicked. Isaiah chapter 26 and verse 10 talks about this. Isaiah 26 and verse 10 says, "Let favor," and favor is more or less the same thing as grace in the Old Testament. "So let favor, let grace be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly, and will not behold the majesty of the Lord." So God says here, if you show grace to the wicked, and what he means is, if he does something wicked, and instead of punishing him, you show him grace. You let him off. What does he do? I mean, when you let the wicked get away with it, they often say, "Oh man, they let me get away with it. Oh, I feel so bad. I'm never going to do that again." Now, that's not usually how the wicked respond, is it? Say, "Oh, I got away with it. Great. Now I can do it again. I got away with it. And maybe I'll do it even more next time." No, if you show grace to the wicked, he will not learn righteousness. It says, in the land of uprightness, he will deal unjustly. In other words, if he was surrounded, everybody else in the land was upright. And he was wicked, and you let him get away with being wicked. Well, even in the land of uprightness, he'd keep right on being wicked. So God knows that showing grace to wicked men is not going to result in those wicked men learning righteousness, learning better. And yet we live in the dispensation of the grace of God, Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 2. So as God shows grace to wicked men, the result is that they keep right on being wicked. And God knows that, but he decided to bring in his dispensation of grace regardless. He was ready for that. He's sufficient for it. But because of God showing grace to the wicked, the result is that wicked men and seducers wax worse and worse. And that shouldn't surprise us. Now I'm saying that this is a prophecy of men in the last days. Verse 2. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. Well, you read this list, you might say, how can this be a prophecy of the end of this dispensation? Because haven't men always been this way? So how could we say this is what it'll be like at the end of this dispensation? Well, hasn't it always been like this since the fall? Well, how does a doctor diagnose an illness? Or you go to the doctor and say, I have a fever. You say, aha, I know what caused that. No, he can't. A fever could be caused by a whole lot of things. Knowing I have a fever, it doesn't tell him a little bit, doesn't tell him much. Then you say, I have a fever and a cough. I have a fever and a cough and I'm sick to my stomach. And you start adding more things in, and then he can diagnose it, right? Because each time you add more in, it narrows down what it could be. So the way you diagnose an illness is by multiple symptoms, not just by one. And so what we have here are 21 symptoms, which when added together would give the Bible's diagnosis of the last days of the dispensation of grace. So even though we can look at these symptoms separately and say, well, haven't there always been men who are like this? It's when we see these symptoms all together and common, just the common reality of the majority of people, see, that's when we diagnose and say we're living in the last days. So we have to take all these symptoms together, and then they give us our diagnosis. Now, people have argued about this phrase, for men shall be. Now, men there is the Greek word anthropos. It means people. So it's not just males, it's people. But they wonder, which ones? Does this mean everyone will be this way? Or I've actually heard some people argue that it means believers. Because they say, well, worldly people are always this way. It just means when believers get this way, then we're living in the last days. Or would it mean just Israelites? Well, I wouldn't think that, because this is Paul speaking the dispensation of grace. All nations are equal. So, of course, it's not just Israelites, but it could it mean just believers? Well, it seems to me that men shall be opens it up to the widest possible application. Now, it's certainly true that believers often get caught up in the culture around them. And they often get caught up in the way of thinking, even the wicked way of thinking of people around them. That happens. And I don't think that this means just believers. I think this means that men in general will be this way in the last days. And again, put all these 21 symptoms together, and then we diagnose the syndrome of the last days. Now, does this mean that if it's the last days, everyone has to be this way? You have no choice. You have to live like this. Well, no. No, this doesn't take away personal responsibility. You don't have to be this way just because you're living in the last days. And you have a possibility of going against the flow. Believers always have the option of going against the flow and living for God. However, if you don't go against the flow, if you just get caught up in the flow and live like all the people around you, then you become part of the syndrome of the last days. If not, well then good. That's what you should be doing. So now let's look at this. I believe these, what I call the 21 symptoms of the last days of the dispensation of grace. And the first we have there in number one, this know also that in the last days, perilous times shall come. So symptom number one is perilous times. Or we could say these are dangerously violent times. The Greek word kalepas, C-H-A-L-E-P-A-S, means dangerously violent. And the only other occurrence is in Matthew chapter 8 and verse 28. Where the Lord and his disciples just crossed the sea. He calmed the storm. Matthew 8, 28, it says, "And when he was come to the other side, into the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two possessed with devils, coming out of the tombs, exceeding fierce, so that no man might pass by that way." And that word, exceeding fierce, is that same Greek word, kalepos, exceeding fierce. So there they translated exceeding fierce, here they translated it perilous. So perilous times, you could say periods of peril or periods of ferocity. And the idea is these periods come quickly, one on the other on the other. That's what it means by perilous times. So there are periods of peril, one following fast on the other. Well, if we consider the violence that seems so common today, the threats that we have now that mankind never had before, like the threat of nuclear or biological warfare, when has humanity ever seen perils like these? Well, again, this is a result of God being gracious, is that men don't get more righteous, they get more wicked, and times get more perilous. So symptom number one, perilous times. Symptom number two, for men shall be lovers of their own selves. So lovers of themselves is symptom number two. Or self-lovers. The Greek here is philautos. P-H-I-L-A-U-T-O-S. And I'm going to give you a new doctrinal phrase here. That's called a hapax legomenon. What's a hapax legomenon? It means a word that only appears once in Scripture. And those words are always kind of hard, because the way we figure out what Greek and Hebrew words mean is we see what does it mean in every passage where the Lord uses it. You say it's unclear in this passage, you go to another passage, maybe it becomes more clear. Well, if it's a hapax legomenon, if it only appears once, then you can't do that, right? There's no other passage that has it. So you're stuck. You can say this is the only passage that's in. What does it mean? It's kind of hard. So this is a hapax legomenon. But we can help figure out what it means by taking it apart. First of all, Phil. We have that in like our city name, Philadelphia. Right? City of brotherly love. Philae, love. I've talked about Greeks had different words for love. Our English word for love is so generic. You say, I love pizza. I love sports. I love my children. I love my parents. I love my spouse. I love God. I love my friends. That same word for all those different kinds of feelings. I mean, I hope you don't feel the same about your pizza and your spouse. And yet you use love for both. So maybe. I'm not saying you all love pizza, but your favorite food, whatever it is. Well, see, the Greeks had more specific words for love. They didn't just have one generic word. And philae love was affection, like between friends. Like your love for your friends. A close, an affectionate feeling. You have affection for people or things. That would be philae love. Affectionate love. And autos. You all probably drove here, and except for if you live here, but even then, you probably have driven here, in an automobile. Well, mobile means a mover, right? When you say I'm mobile, you mean I can move around. You get sick, you're not very mobile. You're kind of in bed. But usually you want to be mobile, right? An auto means self. So you drive around in an automobile, you're in a self mover. It doesn't take a horse. It's a self mover. So philautos means you're affectionate toward yourself. Your friendship, love, your affections are poured out on yourself. So these are self-lovers. And self-lovers are those who care unduly or supremely for themselves. And this causes them to feel that any wish or desire they may have justifies any moral action they may take. Because after all, I want it, and I love myself, so I should have it. This leads, of course, to self-indulgence. And self-indulgence, I don't think I have to convince you, is increasingly common in our culture. So, men shall be self-lovers. And of course, that one helps to explain a lot of the ones that come after it, doesn't it? Is that they are primarily affectionate towards only themselves. Well, next we have covetous. Covetous. And that could perhaps more accurately be stated as lovers of money. The Greek word is philargyros. Again, coming from philae, fond or affectionate love, like toward friends. Argyros actually means silver. Lovers of silver. You know, some years ago when my parents were young, there was a big boom on buying silver. Turned out to be kind of a scam, and a lot of people lost money. But the nice thing is, of course, silver is really worth something, so you couldn't lose everything. But it had got pumped way up in value, and then it came way down. But there have been times when people have loved silver, but I think it probably extends out to meaning love of money, not just of silver specifically. But the other, if we want to understand this word, understand in Luke 16 and verse 14, it's used of the Pharisees. When the Lord talks about you can't serve two masters, you can't serve God and Mammon, the God of money. It says, the Pharisees also who were covetous, that's philargyros again, lovers of money, affectionate toward money. They heard all these things and they derided him. They ridiculed him because, of course, what he said hit too close to home. They were lovers of money. So loving money can lead to many things today. Overwork. Working so much you neglect your family. Neglect the people. You can always say, oh, I'm doing it for my family so they have more good things, but they just don't have you. Can lead to overspending. Right? That happens commonly today. People go way into debt. Why? Because they love wealth. They don't want to live within their means. They want to live as if they had more. It leads to breakups over money. Say one of the most common complaints of couples when they're getting divorced is they just couldn't get along about money. One of the most common arguments after marriage is about money. Because of course, everybody has a different view of how you should treat money. Well, we just love money. The love of money can lead to, of course, the rash of gambling. It's hard to believe when I was a kid, gambling was illegal in my state. It hasn't been for a long time. But gambling, of course, people want more money. They love money. They want more of it. So men shall be lovers of money. Symptom number four, boasters. And this word actually means ostentatious. Greek alazones, A-L-A-Z-O-N-E-S. Greek alazones. Now this appears elsewhere only in the book of Romans. Romans chapter 1 and verse 30 has a list, which I'm only going to read once because there are quite a few of the terms here in 2 Timothy 3 that are repeated in Romans 1. Romans 1, of course, is talking about the downward spiral of mankind away from God, which starts with not retaining him in their minds and not being thankful, and ends with just total wickedness and from beginning to end in your lifestyle. Romans 1:29, it says, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, there's Elizones, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful. So that's the sad state mankind gets in when they reach the bottom of the spiral away from God. And that's the last step below homosexuality, is to just be completely wicked in just about every aspect of life. And not only be wicked yourself, but approve of others who are wicked. Approve of it. So, boasters. It speaks of those who are ostentatious. And self-promoters. People who are self-promoters, and they often promote themselves not backed up by the facts. Empty pretension. And that's seen most sadly in many religious activities and claims. People who claim to be things that they're not. And we should all know 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 5, which tells us that there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. And this tells us that there's only one mediator, only one stand-in, only one go-between between God and us. And that's Christ himself. And yet there are always people who ostentatiously want to claim to be mediators. For example, the claim to be a healer. Say, oh, I don't do it. God does it through me. That makes you a mediator. Makes you standing between God and other people. And that's just an empty claim. Now, some people make these claims honestly, believing them to be true. They're self-deceived. Others purposely claim things that are not true in order to benefit themselves. But ultimately, this is boasters, ostentatious, claiming to be things that they're not. Then we have symptom number 5, proud. Proud or haughty. Greek is huperephanos. It appears in Romans 1:30, which we just read. Mary uses it in Luke 1. Remember when she came to Elizabeth, and Elizabeth praised her because of the child she was going to have, and then Mary spoke what traditionally has been called her Magnificat, Mary's Magnificat, in Luke 1. But in Luke 1:51, she says of the Lord, he hath showed strength with his arm. He hath scattered the proud in their imagination of their hearts. He hath scattered the proud. That's the same Greek word, huperephanos. And then both James 4:6 and 1 Peter 5:5 quote the same Old Testament passage, so we'll just look at James 4:6, since 1 Peter 5:5 is just a quote of the same verse in Proverbs. James 4, verse 6 says, but he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, quote, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. And that's Proverbs 3:34 that James is quoting, that Peter quotes in 1 Peter 5:5. So the proud is one who takes more honor to himself than is justifiably due. A proud one is one who steals credit that rightfully should belong to another. And you see this all too often in politicians, who tax people for money, then give the tax money away and claim the credit for being generous with other people's money. Look at all the tax money I gave you. Well, it didn't come out of your pocket. It came out of somebody else's pocket, yet they're trying to buy votes with someone else's money. The best way to do it, right? With someone else's money. Well, that's a great example of claiming credit that isn't really due to yourself. There are plenty of people today who claim credit that is not really due. That's the proud. Then we have blasphemers, symptom number six. Blasphemers or calumniators. The Greek word is blasphemos. Thus our word blasphemy is really a Greek word, not an English word. We've brought it straight over. Now we use blasphemy generally for anyone who speaks against God. But really the Greek word blasphemos refers to speaking maliciously against anyone. And we can see that in its occurrences in Acts chapter 6, where the unbelieving Jews were bringing false accusations against Stephen and then dragged him before the Sanhedrin. Acts chapter 6 and verse 11, it says, those of the synagogue of the freed slaves who were, opposed Stephen, it says, they suborned men. They corrupted them or bribed them. They suborned men, which said, we have heard him, that is Stephen, speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God. So notice they say he blasphemed Moses and God. Then verse 13, they set up false witnesses which said, this man ceaseth not to speak blasphemous words against this holy place, that is the temple, and the law. So Stephen was accused of four things, blaspheming God, yes, but also blaspheming Moses, the temple, and the law. So notice that. Blasphemy is not just against God. It can be against the things of God. And sometimes it's even used for speaking against just other people. A calumniator or a blasphemer is one who accuses falsely or maliciously. It's one who seeks by aspersion and vilification to destroy the reputation of another person. Now this is a primary weapon of politics, isn't it? To cast aspersions on your opponent. To vilify him, to destroy his reputation so that you'll get elected.
Racist.
Yeah, yep. That's always a nice one to claim. Someone else, try to vilify them. This calumniation, blasphemy, is also one of the chief tool of fanatical extremists. Is that they will calumniate all who disagree with them. So men will be blasphemers against God and against other people. Symptom number seven, disobedient to parents or stubborn toward parents. The Greek word there is apeithes, A-P-E-I-T-H-E-S. And it's used in the same way in Romans 1 and verse 30 that we already read. It means stubborn, unpersuadable, or in obstinate opposition. And this is an obvious social condition of modern times. And I think we have a tendency not to realize that. You mean go back to 100, 150 years ago? Were children expected to rebel against their parents? No. No, they weren't. Absolutely not. Children were expected to love and respect their parents. Even if their parents weren't so lovable and respectable, they were expected to love their parents. And yet today, we just figure some children rebel. Oh, it's just a phase. We all did the same thing. It's normal. Well, that shows how the culture we grow up in is what we expect. We have no idea if it's normal or not. It's normal to us. And with our little tiny perspective on thousands of years of history, if it's normal to us, we think it's normal. But this is an obvious condition of modern times that I'm afraid has spread not just through our own society and culture, but through the world. Now, sometimes this is caused by parents being less than respectable. You look at some parents and say, I can see why their kids don't respect them. Might be an obstinate opposition to them. But that still doesn't excuse this behavior. So in the last days, it says men will be stubborn, unpersuadable, in obstinate opposition toward their parents. Number eight symptom is unthankful. And literally, that is without grace. It's acharistos. And as I've told you before, the Greek word charis, C-H-A-R-I-S, is a word for grace. In fact, it's a Greek girl's name. You'll find a lot of Greek girls will be named charis. It means grace. Now you put an A in front, right? That's just, you know what an A means, right? You say a theist, that's someone who believes in God. You put an A in front and say an atheist means someone who doesn't have a God. Right? An atheist doesn't have a God. A theist has a God or believes in a God. An atheist doesn't believe in a God. So you take charis and then put an A in front of it. And instead of gracious, you get graceless. A graceless person. And this refers to people who have no proper feeling for favors received. They have no willingness either to acknowledge or to repay a debt or a benefit. People are this way toward each other, and they're especially this way toward God. People today don't want to acknowledge that they owe God anything. Luke chapter 6 and verse 35. Christ says, "But love ye your enemies, and do good, and lend, hoping for nothing again. And your reward shall be great, and ye shall be called the children of the highest." Then he says, "For he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil." So God is kind, God is gracious to the graceless and to the evil, to the unthankful and to the evil. So these are people who have no gratitude and no response to favors and benefits that come their way. Acharistos, gracelessness, can also refer to anything that lacks attractiveness or charm. And we can see that in our society and culture, that the rude and the crude is popular. You know, manners are just out of vogue. Nobody wants to have manners. The rude and crude behavior is considered, well, being natural, right? Don't want to put anything on. You just want to be rude and crude, lacking in grace. It also is those who minimize their own faults. Those who are graceless minimize their own faults, and yet they refuse to overlook the faults of others. You know people that way? Their own faults are meaningless. But boy, you better not have a fault. And those who are graceless are also those who will not do anything without the promise of some reward. Right? Because that's grace. Doing things without benefit to yourself. So they will not do anything without the promise of some reward. They are graceless. Acharistos. Symptom number 9. Unholy. Unfortunately, that one is a poor translation. Should probably be something like unbenign or malignant. The Greek is anosios. And it's not the word that would be properly translated unholy. Anosios is used for a tumor, which spreads and grows with destructive power. So it's used for those who are inclined to inflict suffering or to cause distress. Those who are simply disposed to do harm. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 9 speaks of this same characteristic. It says, "Knowing this," 1 Timothy 1 verse 9, "knowing this, that the law is not made for a righteous man, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and for sinners, for unholy," that's the same word there, anosios, "and profane, for murderers of fathers, murderers of mothers, and for manslayers." So those who are malignant, destructive, And the growth of child abuse is one outgrowth of this sort of characteristic in men. They are destructive, unbenign, and malicious. Verse 3. Without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. So symptom number 10 is without natural affection. Or we could translate that if we wanted to make that a single word, like it is in Greek, we could make it calloused. The Greek word is astorgos. Now this comes from the Greek stergo, S-T-E-R-G-O, which means to love. Now this might be a new one. I've shared with you so many times about Greek words for love. I'm usually sharing agape, right? That's the self-sacrificial love. Phile, which is the love of affection. They haven't heard so much about stergo. What is stergo love as opposed to agape or phile? Well, the noun, stergo means to love. That's the verb. The noun would be storge. So we have agape, phile, storge. Storge love is natural love. For example, the love between children and parents, or between siblings. That's storge love. Just natural love. And so those who are astorgos are those who are calloused or hardened in their sensibility and feeling, particularly toward those who they might naturally be expected to love just from natural tendency. It's used in Romans 1:31, again, that same list. Again, the lack of natural love toward those who might naturally be expected to love can be seen in child abuse. Now, this time, particularly of one's own children. Of course, a lot of child abuse takes place when, you know, some girl's latest boyfriend is around her children. It's often not the father, it's the next man or two or three down the road. But it's not always that, is it? Sometimes it's abuse of one's own children. The abuse, spousal abuse. Abortion, a mother. Imagine, a pregnant mother puts to death her own baby. Who could imagine such a thing? I read a book from the 1850s, 1860s, and he's trying to picture Lilith, who's supposed to be the second worst being next to Satan. And she is so bad, she kills her own daughter. I mean, that's got to be second to Satan, right? Oh, boy. I thought, you have no idea. You have no idea. So how could anyone be so unfeeling? But men in the last days are astorgos, without just natural love. Number 11, truce breakers. Or we could translate this one, implacable. The Greek word is aspondos, A-S-P-O-N-D-O-S. That's also in Romans 1:31 and nowhere else. Those who are implacable are those who are not satisfied until they have done their worst. These are people who are devoid of any feeling that would cause them to relent or to restrain through compassion the violence of their rage and of their hostility. Now we can see this in the rash of violent crimes where even compliant victims are beaten, sometimes even to death. Those who will beat babies to death for crying, and so forth. These are people who are not satisfied, not restrained until they've done their worst. And it can be seen in people who aren't satisfied until they have either destroyed the reputations or even the lives of their enemies. People are implacable. Then symptom number 12 is false accusers. False accusers. We might make that either slanderers or devils. The Greek word is diabolos. You've probably heard of that, diabolos. That's a Greek word for the devil. And it's translated devil in 35 of 38 occurrences in the Bible. But what is a devil? Is it some little red guy with horns and a tail and a pitchfork? No, that's not a devil. Devil doesn't look like that at all. He goes around looking like an angel of light, remember? But a devil is specifically a slanderer. That's what Satan does. He slanders. But a devil is one who speaks evil with the intent of injuring and without regard for truth. Of course, slander is a common weapon in politics. And it's also very common in the tongues of gossipy people. But beyond just slander, I think devil often characterizes men today when we consider their acts. The Lord, in John 8 and verse 44, accused certain people, and he said to them, "Ye are of your father the devil, and the lusts, the strong desires of your father, ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar, and the father of it." So symptom number 12 is men are devils. Symptom number 13. We have incontinent, which means simply uncontrollable. Greek is akrates. And that's another hapax legomenon. Occurs only here. Akrates speaks of one who restrains no desire. We see that's common today regarding sexual desires. And I'm afraid that our society teaches from childhood, teaches that there should be no restraint on sexual desires. And this removes integrity and commitment from marriage. And it leaves destruction in its wake, especially destruction in the lives of children. However, the uncontrollable nature of men today can be seen in, for example, the rash of obesity, of drug addiction, of alcoholism, of gambling, and of violence. Yes, as we look around ourselves today, we could say that godly restraint seems to be a forgotten skill in our society. He says, in the last days, men will be incontinent, uncontrollable. Number 14, symptom 14, is fierce or brutal. Greek is anemeros, another hapax legomenon, occurs only here. Speaks of those who are inhuman or cruel. You know, our society boasts that we have risen up from a savage state, a slow advance from a savage state. And yet a truly savage spirit exists today, displaying more a slide downward than a climb upward. Many people today are deceived by the advance of technology to think that humanity is getting better. And yet, the advance of our technology does not hide our moral decline. Our people are increasingly brutal. And we see that, for example, in violence in the news, in abuse, and in murder of the weak and the innocent. So, symptom number 14 is that people are brutal. Then despisers of those that are good. Or this could be despisers of goodness. It's a single Greek word again. Aphilagathos. And it's another hapax legomenon. Occurs only here. The feel, right? Affectionate. Without affection. Then agathos. things that are good. So people have no affection for anything that's good. This is displayed in those who would destroy any moral landmark or any upstanding principle simply because they have no relish for goodness, for that which is good. We can see this in Isaiah chapter 5. He complains of this in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. In Isaiah 5 and verse 20, Isaiah says this. He says, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." And this sort of spirit is increasingly plain today as there are more and more people who decry righteousness and who applaud wickedness. Despisers of those that are good are never neutral. It's never just that they love wickedness. They also hate righteousness. They're rebels against God and against His righteous order. And as Paul says later on, verse 5, we indeed should turn from all who despise goodness. Verse 4, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. So we have traitors. That's the Greek word prodotes. And perhaps the easiest way to explain that one is to say that it's used of Judas Iscariot in Luke chapter 6 and verse 16. Benedict Arnold, yes. Judas, the traitor. In Acts 7:52, Stephen accuses the Sanhedrin. He says, "Which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted? And they have slain them which showed before of the coming of the Just One, of whom ye, you, Sanhedrin, have been now the betrayers and murderers." You know, the Sanhedrin had been set up in Israel. Their task was to recognize the Messiah when he came. That's why the Sanhedrin was supposedly set up in Jerusalem. Their primary task was to recognize the Messiah when he came. And when he came, what did they do? They betrayed him. They were traitors, just like Judas. So men in the last days will be betrayers. And this would speak of those who would betray the Lord, His word, and His work. We can see today that people have little loyalty. And we can see how quickly people leave their jobs. You know, loyalty to your company is passé. Not anymore. And how quickly they leave their marriages. And even how quickly people will leave their children. There is just no loyalty. Their disloyalty to the Lord is seen how freely they bring the Lord's name into their own activities. And they pay no heed whatsoever to the damage they might do to His name by doing that. They reject the truth of His word. They betray the truth. And they use the Lord's work to promote their own gain at the expense of those whom they should be helping and ministering to. Yes, people today are traitors. Number 17, heady. Well, that's not a word that we use very often in modern English. Rash would be a better word. The Greek word is propates. It's used in Acts 19:36, where, remember, the Ephesian mob got so mad because the smiths were mad because Paul was convincing people that gods made with hands aren't gods at all. And the town clerk, they were shouting out in the, they ran into the amphitheater, were shouting, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." The town clerk finally quieted them down and said, "Let's not do anything rash." Use the same word. So it's imprudent hastiness in word or in action. And it's seen in those who rush in the pursuit of their own will. It can be seen in the rush of the young to get married, or I'm afraid is more common today, in their rush to, quote-unquote, live together, to shack up without being married at all. So they rush to get together, and then they rush to break apart again. Rush to get divorced or to break up. They rush to break apart their children's families. We can see this in the rush of nations to go to war. We can see this in people's sudden changes in belief. And their disavowals of Christ for the smallest of reasons. I didn't like a verse in Deuteronomy, so Christ is out the window. We can see this in precipitous mobs and riots. We see rashness on every hand. And it seems that prudence is a rare quality in these days. So number 17, rash. Now number 18, high-minded, which means conceited. The Greek is tuphao. And Paul uses it elsewhere, twice only, it's elsewhere in 1 Timothy. Chapter 3 and verse 6, he's advising Timothy who to make an overwatcher. And he says, "Don't make a novice, a new believer, an overwatcher, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil." And lifted up with pride there is tuphaomai. Lifted up with pride. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 4, he says that one who teaches otherwise is proud, knowing nothing. So those who are conceited. Now this means their minds are beclouded or besotted. And so they become blindly or stupidly foolish. It could speak to those whose minds are deranged by drugs. Or those whose thinking is besotted by sin. The fact is that many people do not wish to see clearly the truth about their own sinful actions. And so, they are conceited, they are blinded in this way. So their own conceit blinds them to the truth. Then, symptom number 19, they are lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. Lovers of pleasure there is another hapax legomenon. It occurs only here. It's philedinos. Phile, again, affectionate love. And hedonos. That sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Hedonos. It speaks those whose affections are on fulfilling their own desires. We talk about hedonism, right? Hedonism. Do anything to fulfill your own desires. Well, that's what this is. Philhedonos. And who could deny this reality today, that men love pleasure? A more accurate description of men's present attitude could hardly be given. And it seems that in our day, people live and die for entertainment. Heard that phrase, "I live for the weekend"? I think that's just not a cute phrase. A lot of people really do that. Right? They go to work, they do their jobs, they live just for the time they get off and are able to be entertained. That's what life is all about for them, is for those times of entertainment. And of course, "I'm bored." Common complaint of our young people. Right? It shows their love for and their dependence on entertainment. They just feel they always need to be entertained. In our society, food is entertainment. Often we sit around and talk about the nutritional quality of our food. More often it's, I like this, I like that. I love peaches, I hate pickles. You know, we aren't talking about, I need to eat to survive. If I had enough nutrition to make it, no, food is entertainment. No wonder we aren't very, very thankful for it. We are far removed from eating to live. Sadly, in our society, sex is also used for entertainment. And this results in relationships that seem to be less committed than a fan's relationship to his favorite television program. So this seems to have started out in American culture, yet it's spreading around the world. This love for an addiction to entertainment. The fact is that life shouldn't be about entertainment. It should be about the people for whom we're responsible and working for the things that matter. And of course, for believers especially, it should be about God. Yet for most of us, we would rather be entertained. Now, it's not just loving pleasure, notice, but it's lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. And lovers of God, here that's philotheos. Again, phile, affectionate, and theos, meaning God. So it's not that entertainment is bad of itself. Of course, who of us doesn't like to be entertained? Entertainment's good sometimes. Sometimes you need a break. It's nice to be entertained. So entertainment isn't wrong in and of itself. But to love entertainment more than to love things that are important, and particularly God, is to have things severely out of their proper order. That God is far more important than pleasure. And yet people today are lovers of pleasures far more than they're lovers of God. Symptom number 20, we get to verse 5. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. From such turn away. And godliness there could also be devoutness, is the idea. Devoutness, godliness, devoutness. And this speaks of people who have a put-on facade of godliness. Unbiblical and unspiritual Christianity is the greatest religion in the world today. And in this religion, the forms of godliness predominate, while the real power of godliness is denied. The fact is that most Christians, quote unquote, have a profound ignorance of everything biblical. Faith is called important. Oh, you've got to have faith. But few people seem to pay any attention to faith in what. People put on a show of piety. Show up at church, do good works, look good to other people. And yet then they live the same wicked, God-denying lifestyle of the culture around them. And isn't that supposed to be the power of devoutness? Power here is dunamis. So we get our word dynamite from it. It speaks of inherent power. And there is truly power in godliness. But many people who claim to serve God show no signs of the power of godliness in their lives. This is shameful and unworthy of anyone who names the name of Christ. Paul says, from such people, those who have a form of godliness, devoutness, but deny its power, he says, from such people turn away. Don't have anything to do with them. But some people complain, wouldn't that be hypocritical for sinners to do? After all, we're all sinners. None of us are perfect. None of us are always righteous. So how can we turn away from people? Well, now look, people who are only outward, their godliness is only a put-on show. These are not our brothers and sisters. These are not our brothers and sisters. Our brothers and sisters are those who truly have a relationship with Christ, not those who just put it on the outside. And if we mingle with those who only have a form of godliness yet deny its power, well then, we damage our own witness. And we tempt ourselves toward the same kind of empty hypocrisy. So Paul says, turn away from all people who have just an outward show of devoutness to God, but they deny the true power of devoutness in their lives. Verse 6, for of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women, laden with sins, led away with diverse lusts. Now this is interesting. Those who creep into houses. How would anyone creep into houses, sneak into houses? Well, for example, how about via television? Have you considered, would you let a person into your home who's going to sit down with your young children, start to teach them? Teach them contrary to your morality, contrary to your worldview, contrary to everything you think is right. Do so in a charismatic way. Speak better than you ever could. With illustrations and music, everything to attract children, go along with it. Would you allow such a person into your home? You kick him out. You say, get out of here. Never darken my door again. How dare you try to do that to my children? And yet, what do we do with the television every day? Sit our children down in front of it. And what does the television do but teach them the opposite of what we believe in a better way, in a more convincing way with audio and visual and make it all seem wonderful and right? Yes, we allow wicked people to creep into our houses. Now these people creep into houses and they lead captive silly women. This word is gunaikarion, and it's a term of contempt. Foolish women. And the idea of little is in there. So you might say silly little women. Foolish, despicable women. Now these silly little women are taken captive. But they are taken captive because of their own contemptible character. So these house creepers come to these silly little women and they appeal to them through their sins and through their strong desires. That's what diverse lusts are, right? They're different kinds of strong desires. Now, does that remind you of anything, maybe? Advertising? What does advertising do but appeal to people's sin and their strong desires? So he says, these silly, contemptible little women are led astray by this sort of person. By this person who has a form of devoutness on the outside, but denies the power. They lead captive silly little women through their sins and their desires. Verse 7. Ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Think of the knowledge that's available to us today through the internet. I mean, I could go and I can browse the Vatican Library. I don't have to fly to Rome. You know, I can see all the paintings on the Sistine Chapel. I don't have to go to the Sistine Chapel. And think of all these things. I could study medical journals and anything I wanted at the touch of a button. Yet has this rise of information technology led our people to a real factual knowledge of God's truth? Has that proliferated along with our information technology? No, the fact is that information proliferates at the same time that knowledge of God deteriorates. And the more people seem to learn, the less they seem to know about the things that are most important. And of course, God is the most important thing of all. So people today seem to be ever learning and yet somehow never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Verse 8. Now as Jannes and Jambres withstood Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds, reprobate concerning the faith. So here we have symptom number 21, which is the Jannes and Jambres syndrome. Now these two names occur only here. So we say, who in the world were Jannes and Jambres? Well, there are two clues here to tell us who they were. Number one, which you can't necessarily tell without researching it, but Jannes and Jambres are names that have an Egyptian origin. They're Egyptian names. Second of all, by the fact that it said that they withstood or resisted Moses. Now, Jewish tradition names these two as the two magicians who withstood Moses before Pharaoh. Now, sometimes I think we almost get the idea that the Jews couldn't have any source of history other than the Bible. Well, why is that so? And we have plenty of sources of history other than the Bible. And we know there was a guy named Abraham Lincoln who was our president and was shot, so forth. Why? Did anybody alive today ever meet him? No. Is anybody alive today there when he got shot? No. But we have historical records, right? So the Jews had sources of history besides the Bible. Now, that's not to say that their sources were always right. Things got mixed up over time, especially when they were repeated by word of mouth and not written down. But in this case, apparently their tradition was correct because the Holy Spirit, by inspiration, puts his stamp of approval on it. That they had correctly remembered all down through the centuries the names of these two magicians. Jannes means he vexed. And Jambres means foamy healer. Now these two magicians, remember, they counterfeited Moses' miracles. Remember when Moses turned his rod into a snake? They took their rods and turned it into a snake. I always like how God turned it around because then Moses' snake ate their snakes. So, but still, they copied Moses' miracle. They counterfeited the turning of the water into blood. They counterfeited the bringing up of frogs into Egypt. But then they got their comeuppance. They were stopped when they tried to bring up lice. They couldn't do it. But they resisted Moses by counterfeiting his miracles. Now, many people today claim to be miracle workers or healers, but they make this claim falsely. And these people are withstanding God's truth for today, whether they realize it or not. Now others resist because they do realize it, but they are men of corrupt minds. Men of corrupt minds reprobate concerning the faith. So their thoughts are not in line with belief in God's word. They don't believe it. They are reprobate from it. And their minds are corrupted. And for this reason, they resist the truth. Well, what's the end of these wicked last days men? Verse 9. But they shall proceed no further. For their folly shall be manifest unto all men, as theirs also was. So what is God ever going to do about wicked men like this, the wicked men in the last days? Well, he says their end is going to be they shall proceed no further. In our figure, we would say they are stopped in their tracks. Well, how are they stopped in their tracks? It says their folly. The Greek word there is anoia, which means mindlessness or insanity. Their folly, their mindlessness, their insanity, the insanity of their wickedness becomes obvious to everyone, right? Manifest unto all men means obvious to everyone. Well, that's what happened to Jannes and Jambres, right? Eventually, God's power showed them up. You know, the plagues came on them. They had the boils, and they couldn't even appear before Pharaoh, because they had been struck down by God. So in the same way, God's power is going to show up these wicked last days men. When? Well, when his kingdom comes. That's what brings a stop to wicked men. And nothing short of that could. is when God's kingdom comes, these wicked people will be stopped in their tracks. So God is not going to allow the present wicked flow of this world to continue forever. He's not going to allow us to go until we destroy ourselves. No, he's going to bring a stop to wicked men and make the insanity of their wickedness obvious to all. And of course, that happens once this dispensation is over and when God starts his kingdom. So in this portion, God through Paul gives us a prophecy of 21 conditions that will prevail in the last days of this long dispensation of grace. And I believe we see many of these conditions prominent among men today, and some of them as never before. For example, the disobedient to parents. So this leads me to conclude that we live in the last days of this dispensation of grace. God will not allow all this wickedness to go on forever, or to go on until we end up destroying ourselves. No, he is going to put a stop to it, not in the dispensation of grace, of course, but when he brings his kingdom in at last. Well, let us all live looking for the day when he finally intervenes gloriously in the affairs of this world. But that is 2 Timothy chapter 3, the prophecy for today.